Welcome to Talent Management Truths. I'm your host, Lisa Mitchell. I'm a talent management thought partner and results coach, wife, and mom. Talent management leaders are hungry to learn from their peers and want to hear about real-life talent initiatives. This podcast is for and by talent management leaders. My guests and I dig into successes, challenges, and lessons learned from a very practical, not theoretical, point of view. You'll discover important insights about how to elevate your confidence and amplify your influence in a role known for being caught in the organizational middle. I'm thrilled to have you listening. So let's get going and hear the truth about talent management today. Are you an HR or talent department of one in a smaller organization? Have you ever been? Or maybe you're considering a move that would give you this experience. Regardless, today's episode will give you food for thought and some surprising insights. My guest is Jule Von Kempf. Jule has spent the last 12 years driving the HR experience for startups. She brings grit, passion, resourcefulness, and authenticity to her work. She is currently the head of people at CoinMe, a cryptocurrency organization that has as its goal making cryptocurrency accessible to all. She's responsible for all aspects of people operations and loves what she does. She brought so much wisdom and humor to our conversation. I know you will enjoy this. Hello and welcome back to Talent Management Truths. I'm your host, Lisa Mitchell, and today I'm joined by Jule Von Kempf. Jule is head of people for CoinMe. It's a pleasure to have you today on the show, Jule.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Awesome. So let's start off by you sharing with our listeners a little bit about who you are and your career journey to date.
Yeah, I'm Jule, as you mentioned. I've been in HR for a while now, but only at startups, which I think is kind of special. So I started off my career, I guess even while I was in college, I was a wildland firefighter. And I kind of thought that was the direction I was going to go in, like for, you know, the remainder of my professional career. But as I, you know, graduated from college, I thought to myself, like, I don't know if I really want to be a wildland firefighter. You know, I might
wild want to land. Did you say wildland?
I said wildland, yeah.
Wildland.
So, and it was great. And it's fun. There's adrenaline. There's good camaraderie. You get to work with a lot of people, but you also get to meet people on all these other crews from, you know, all over the U.S. and sometimes, you know, all over the world. People come from Australia to fight these fires in the U.S. and vice versa. And so it was a great opportunity for me to kind of dip my toes into the working world anyways, as a young adult. But I started to realize that I wanted to be able to date and have a family. And I didn't want to have to deal with that as a wildland firefighter. And I'm sure there are plenty of women that do have families that fight wildland fires. For me personally, I was like, I'm going to move on. So I moved to Seattle and just kind of started doing some odd jobs. I actually went through the process to be a Seattle firefighter, but then I got hit by a car and I was like, that is a sign I should do something different. So I worked some really odd jobs where I, you know, started to really just kind of learn that I like supporting people and helping people. Like that's where my passion lies. And that's where I'd like to, you know, kind of take my trajectory for my career. So I got an opportunity eventually to step into someone's role in HR at a small startup called Three Tier. The previous HR person was stepping aside and the CFO asked me if I wanted to do it. I hadn't done it before. I had to be scrappy. I was the only HR member there. And so I just kind of learned by doing the work, calling, you know, resources. I had no trouble reaching out to people on the phone. I would say it was really strange for like ADP to get a phone call from someone. Be like, how do I run payroll? But I did it. And that was my foray. And it was really interesting because that company had federal contracts. And so there was a lot more to it than just kind of your standard HR. But it was a startup and it went through mergers and acquisitions. And I, you know, in my role went away. So I went to a SaaS company, which was really interesting. The previous company was an energy forecasting company. So a lot more in the renewable energy space. The SaaS company was certainly amazing. There was zero HR when I joined. So, and there hadn't been. So I got to to not only build everything from scratch, but I also got to reinvent it later on, right? So we build out ADP, and then later we switch to a different HRIS. Like, we got to kind of continue to see that work and the people operations evolve, as well as like growing the company, hiring my own boss and mentor, which is, I always recommend if you can hire your own boss.
Yeah.
Go that route. And that was essential because, as I mentioned prior, up until that point, my only HR experience had been just me. I can't assume.
So how did you land at CoinMe, and what do you do there?
So SkyTap had done a great job, and you know, a lot of things had been automated, and the company was growing and going through changes. And I just thought it's a good time for me to move on. And I was really interested in Web3 and cryptocurrency. I didn't actually have any cryptocurrency at the time. I just really wanted to explore it as an industry. And I got an opportunity that I couldn't turn away. So I thought, I'm going to take the dive and the jump and get right into it.
So CoinMe is a cryptocurrency company then?
Yes. Yes. It's hard to describe it for some people if you don't know, but basically CoinMe operates the world's largest fully licensed cryptocurrency cash network with like thousands of locations across 49 states through partnerships with Coinstar and MoneyGram.
Okay.
And working on other partnerships. So we operate with a simple belief that access to digital currency should be easy and accessible to everyone. So really at the core thing that motivates and I think attracts our employees to CoinMe and even people to CoinMe is that we want to make cryptocurrency accessible to people who are underserved and underbanked. And also then typically, I don't know, I'm going to say not as technically advanced as like engineers and, you know, savvy investors. So people who might think that digital currency isn't for them. We see it as a way for people to diversify their wealth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Yeah. So it's fascinating because for some listeners, you know, they may never have sort of dipped into learning more about crypto and so on. So it's neat to hear about a company that's kind of right in the middle of that industry's growth. And you're out of Seattle. Is CoinMe also?
CoinMe was originally based out of Seattle. Yeah, but we are fully spread out across the United States now, Canada, even Puerto Rico, and we have an employee in Croatia. So we certainly spread our footprint a lot.
Okay.
I think we only have, in Washington, we have less than 20 people here now. The rest of our employees are spread out.
Yeah. And I think you said it's around 60 people.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and you know, I'm detecting a bit of a pattern here in your overall career where you've gone from, you know, built from scratch, one person HR department to the next, including where you are now. You're a team, a mighty team of one. So this startup kind of culture gene of all trades is really kind of turned into your calling card, I'd say, Jewel.
It has. And I don't mind it. I mean, I love having a team and I love it when, you know, when a team is built out and there's support and it's definitely necessary. But a lot of the time in startups, you know, when budgets get cut and startups are building, HR is always like, you know, the last to really be built out. I would say over the course of my experience in HR over a decade now, I have seen a shift in that. You know, CEOs, executives, teams are really seeing that value and that ROI that people operations bring to the table. But in small startups, especially like Series A, Series B startups, you know, sometimes it's hard to justify, you know, that HR headcount you might need when you are really just trying to, you know, build a product that you can sell.
Got it. Okay. So tell us a little bit about how your observations of startup culture and you know, you haven't worked, like I really come from quite large organizations, so I'm on the other end of the spectrum. So how would you kind of characterize these smaller startup organizations?
Well, I can only speak from my experience, but I find that in startup culture, employees are more invested and have a stronger kind of passion for what they're doing. And I think it's because, well, for multiple reasons, but one, they might just love the products, and products do tend to have a lot of like energy behind them in startups, right? Because it's new and it's innovative. But also, there's a lot more ownership and autonomy in a startup culture. So it's a lot easier for people to see the value and their impact of what they're bringing to the organization. So that's lovely. And then, of course, in smaller organizations, it's easier to connect with people and to speak your mind and to really kind of show who you are and be able to kind of highlight that as you work. So I find startup cultures to be a lot more collaborative, a lot more open to new ideas, to, you know, it's a lot easier to fail fast at a startup culture than it is at larger organizations. You know, to try something new, if it doesn't work, pivot, try something else. So, and they move a lot faster, which is, I think, a stereotype, but a true stereotype for startups. They really, really do move at a lot faster pace than, you know, a Fortune 500 company would.
Yeah, in many cases. Yeah. And then there are some hybrids out there that are, you know, quite large, quite scaled, and yet have a really entrepreneurial startup culture, just for a variety of reasons. If they've been more on the IT innovation cutting edge side of things, I think that can kind of come with the people that are there. But it really resonated with me when you said it's a lot easier to fail fast, because that's something that, you know, after 25 years in corporate myself in large organizations, looking back and working with clients as I do now, looking in through the window, so to speak, from outside, there is a real reticence to make a mistake. And ironically, that's at a disservice to creating, you know, a space where innovation is welcome and encouraged, right? If people are too scared to put a foot wrong. So I see some companies making progress, making strides to change that. I think failing fast is probably going to be the key to the future now that we've got AI coming in and all kinds of things. So what does it look like to fail fast where you are right now in your role of one, as you've been building everything from scratch?
I mean, I try new things all the time. One of the things that most remote companies, especially remote only companies, are really working on right now is, you know, how do we make sure we're being as productive as we, you know, were when we were in person? And I mean, I think Microsoft like a year ago put out an article saying like their workers weren't as productive. I mean, I would argue with that, though, because I've worked in plenty of offices and tech offices, and there is an incredible amount of time wasted in those offices as well. But that said, it is something that's at the top of, you know, your mind, especially as a remote-only company. So recently, I wanted to put together kind of a culture book, and I failed. I put together too much. It was too much. You know, I presented it in front of my team. I was like psyched. And of course, they were all lovely, but we, you know, it didn't go over. I thought it would be like a big win. It was a flop. But from that flop, I have two different things now. I have a lot of great information I'm going to use to kind of reinvigorate the CoinMe foundations and our orientation model. And then I have the information I need to create kind of, instead of a culture book, like a small poster of, you know, how we were, how we rise, how we show up. So, and there was no shame in that. I presented it. I was proud of it. It didn't resonate. And I was like, all right, let's pivot and we'll see what we can get from it and move forward. So that's a real easy example from an HR standpoint. In the overall business of like innovation and the engineers and product people trying new things out, it's a similar, you know, kind of way of thinking. You know, they come to the table with something that they've had data and input to build and it doesn't work. Doesn't resonate, but no one feels guilty about it, or hopefully they don't. Instead, they're like, well, what can we get from this? And then they create something new that hopefully does work and does resonate. So there's not a shame in failing. There's an ownership in it, but not a shame. And you tried something and you move on. Yeah. And the nice thing about that is it's not like I have this large company that I have to, you know, wait because I have to run things up a ladder, like, you know, tenfold. Yeah. I can just pivot.
Yeah, no shame, just pivot. Yeah, and you know, I appreciate that because that's going to be my new mantra. No shame, just pivot. You know, in my last organization, it was really quite large. And you know, there was discussion of, you know, wanting innovation. And yet, you know, the screws would get put to people if they made mistakes in several cases. And it was kind of too bad because then people stopped speaking up altogether. Whereas here, it's this idea of being iterative, right? And how do we get to the best ideas? And yeah, we've got to try out 10 of them and 9 will be crappy and one's going to be Excellent. Like recently, with a process in my own business, for instance, I had changed something. And I won't get into the details, but it kind of blew up in a good way, created a whole bunch of new work, let's say, in another area of my business that I was trying to kind of fix. And I got angry, Joel. Like I was actually frustrated, angry, like just, oh my God, what am I going to do with this big problem? And it took my coach to sort of say, and I'm a coach myself, but to sort of say, hey, you got exactly what you wanted. And now this is just a new problem that's come as a result. So you've pivoted once, it's created some results you didn't quite expect, which are not bad and they're just results. And so what do you want to do with those going forward? So, you know, after kind of cooling my heels and doing a little writing about that, I was able to kind of do that pivot, right? And figure out, okay, I need to change the original process from before I made this change. And it's made a real difference.
I'm happy for you. I'm really glad that worked out. And you're right. I do. I didn't want to make it sound like I don't get bothered when I fail. I do. But the way in which business itself is changing, just technology and growth, I mean, I would imagine that failing fast would be something that every company is going to have to start to adapt. You're right. With AI, with all the developments, in order for us to be able to even think creatively, we have to be willing to botch it every now and then.
Yeah. You know, just step into it safely. Like there's calculated risk, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's stupid risk. So I think there's something to that. But now something else that I wanted to dig into a little bit too was this idea that, you know, when you and I first met and had a conversation, you had shared that somehow, you know, in spite of being a smaller company in an HR department of one in a startup, you've been able to see the creation of a very inclusive culture where belonging is very much key. And I was hoping you could tell us a bit about what that looks like.
Yeah. And when I say somehow it happens, some of it is intentional, but I have to be honest, I think we've also been lucky just organically in the people that we've brought on board at Coyme. We do obviously hire with like behavioral and emotional EQ in mind. But when I joined Coyme, I did like just kind of a basic like touch point and survey with the executives, managers, as well as employees as to what they loved about Coyme, what they like, what works, what do they want to get out of my role? Like, what would they like to see? And, you know, people overall felt pretty good. And I was like, oh, this is great. But one of the things that they mentioned was as a fully remote company, they were worried that, you know, their individuality would kind of start to kind of, you know, disappear because they would just be showing up as workers. And that they also want to make sure that as the company grows, that they're still, you know, treated equitably and, you know, that we're focusing on growing our culture as much as our people and our revenue. And so with that, we created a DE&I program. And did a basic survey off of that. And I have to be honest, like, you know, when you feel like your company's like got it under wraps, you do those surveys, there's always like surprises. You know, not terrible surprises. It's
when
we do things, right? It's, you know, we're just auditing our employees. And we learned a couple of things that were, you know, that were important to the employees. So one of the easiest wins that any company can do is removing, you know, pronouns out of their documents, like their handbook and their policies, because then it automatically should be speaking, hopefully, to everyone. And, you know, we use they, them, or the employees instead of he, she, hers, his. And of course, then, you know, allowing and giving employees that space to kind of say who they are. And so that was an easy win. We created a, you know, policy like a lot of companies doing right now. And we updated our handbook to include things like, you know, anti-racism policies, speak your mind policies. And then we, as in the executive team, reiterated that in all of our meetings. We just, not only did we kind of reiterate our policies, we also gave room for the employees to tell us if we did something offensive. So even in this, you know, space, if I were to say something that could be offensive that I'm not aware of, then, you know, I invite the employees to reach out to me and let me know so that, you know, I can learn and I can grow. And we've had employees respond to that because they feel like, okay, I have the space, I can reach out. And it always starts with them reaching out to me first, you know, like so-and-so said this. Not to get them in trouble, but they just don't feel comfortable. But eventually, as they start to see like the change in the way we speak and we act, then employees feel comfortable just like reaching out to each other, being like, hey, that meme you put on the Slack, although I can see how it's funny, is also, you know, offensive to my culture. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry. And the employee will take it down. So it's not about, you know, shaming people. It's more about just us being open to it. Then on the recruitment side, it was years ago. And I was hanging out with a bunch of HR professionals. And I just said, I wanted to say regurgitated. I didn't regurgitate anything. But I said this phrase I'd heard in my HR world of recruitment, which is, oh, the pipeline for diversity is just not there. There's no pipeline. I can't get to the pipeline. I'm sure you've heard some sort of variation of this. And this lady just looks at me. And she's, granted, I'm in Washington. She's from New York. And she's just like, oh, Jewel, you're not looking in the right place. And so I was like, what can I do? Like, what should I be doing, you know? And I mean, the answers were some of them were just simple. And I was embarrassed. You know, she's like, well, how many of your external recruiters are people of color? And I start thinking, I'm like, none, you know, like, oh, that's nice. And, you know, she's like, and are you using more than just LinkedIn? Are you using tools that, like, you know, you might have data that people of color or people in the LGBTQIA or people, you know, with different ablenesses might be using? And I was like, sometimes I post things on job boards, but, you know, and so she really helped kind of provide a way for me and then my recruiters at CoinMe that I hired to really reach out. And it was a lot of trial and error. We made sure to, you know, reach out to people at organizations like Women in Tech or Blacks in Engineering and to kind of get their input on, you know, on how we can find or at least make ourselves more attractive and opening and welcoming to candidates. And it really, actually, it really worked out. And we hit all angles. We went not just like people of color. We went through like LGBTQIA communities. We advertised and posted jobs on different ableness and religious areas. And then I live in a very strongly like military area. So I reached out to so a lot of it, we spent time reaching out to our communities and finding out like, what are these pipelines? Like we took the time to learn. And it was really successful. I mean, CoinMe was, we unfortunately, you know, have had some changes over the last year, but prior to those changes, we were over 55% people of color at the organization, which is like bonkers for me as a tech company. And when in hindsight, it feels so natural after making sure that we were just like putting our information out in places that would get a more diverse group of people looking at them.
It's so funny. So yeah, so diverse vehicles, if you will, for recruitment, right? For finding candidates to create diversity. It sounds so simple, you know.
Say it out loud. I mean, we did a lot of education with our employees and our recruiters and stuff to make sure that we're checking our biases because we've all got them, and you know, and they pop into us whether it's a, you know, what you might consider like a positive affinity bias, which is still a bias, or like a negative bias. And so, and one of the things that I found most interesting that came up a few times early on was in interviews, people not looking at the camera or not wanting to turn their camera on. But through our networking, especially with people in neurodivergent communities, we learned that that's not always like optimal for them.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, well, then we won't make it a requirement, you know? And I mean, why does it need to be a requirement? So a lot of asking ourselves questions and changing a lot of pivoting.
I think this is our word of the day. So, so how did you manage training and kind of, you know, like with people from orientation and onward, you know, related to your DEIB strategy?
I mean, in an ideal world, I would have had like a budget to, you know, actually bring some external people in. Not because internal people can't train in the companies, but I just sometimes feel like employees listen better when you have like a subject matter expert. But we didn't have that. So we did our own training. We put together our own trainings, and we had conversations, open and honest conversations with each other. We tested our biases through some of the online, I'm going to say like tests that are available. Like Harvard has a few. Have you ever taken those? They have a couple that you take in your, it's always surprising. You're just like, oh, you're like, I'm taking this test. You're like, I'm nailing it. And then you get the results and you're just like, riddled with bias, which we are. And those things are nice because it, you know, when we do the trainings and we can kind of share those as a group, we're like, oh, we all are. And so we put together our own trainings. We put together our own, you know, kind of conversation groups. And then we just continue those trainings. So I recently did a training on HR 101. I thought people would be bored as heck. It was all about like HR laws, which has a lot to do with like, you know, protections of rights, employee rights. And people were like very attentive and asked a lot of questions. And I was, you know, so we really just created that culture of, I guess, caring about the people we bring in and making sure that we're doing things right by our people.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, because the training is interesting to me because if you don't have a team of learning professionals, you know, to draw on, you're not using external consultants. It sounds like you kind of banded together with other leaders and you know, did sort of, what's the word, a training council approach almost.
Yeah. And I mean, I am part of a couple of groups where I can reach out and ask questions. My portfolio group that, you know, is invested in our company has a kind of list of HR professionals in the group that we can reach out to. Benny added me to their HR advisory, which is like a huge organization of HR professionals that you can kind of reach out to. So I am certainly not above asking people for their advice. And even if they have like a sample of the training that they've given and has it worked and what resonated. So yeah, no need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's part in first cohort of Talent Trust, which is the program I run for HR and talent leaders. It's so funny because we still have our WhatsApp chat group going and it's not like it's super active like when we were in those 6 months. And yet people are still sharing resources, like entire programs with each other and, you know, and then go and work from that. So it's like this ongoing goldmine is how I like to think of it.
I think it's great. I don't, when I first started off in just in business in general, everything seemed so secretive, like mine,
right,
in the way,
yes,
you did things. And I mean, it's certainly extremely different in the industry I work in right now, Web3. Like I could call most companies and probably just speak to someone and they would be happy to tell me how they're doing things. It certainly has changed a lot. And maybe that's part of the, you know, maybe I kind of got kicked into high gear with like the pandemic and people working remotely that we needed, you know, colleagues that were outside of our companies to help
Absolutely.
Us.
Oh yeah. It's so important. So that brings me to, you know, this back to this HR team of one. And I'd like to go over three things in particular. So first, the biggest challenge from your perspective as a pro in this space, the biggest opportunity, because I think for listeners, you know, many of them will relate and some of them won't relate at all, but I think there's learning in this for all of us. So biggest challenge, biggest opportunity, and your most essential piece of advice.
Biggest challenge as an HR, I mean, team of one, I feel like it would be obvious if there's just not enough time, right? So like in HR, Gartner has this like HR priorities list, like this whole kind of matrix, and it is intensive. And I'm like, I want to hit all those things.
Yes.
There's like 20 plus things on those lists. And as an HR person of one, you're doing a lot of task management, a lot of employee relations. And then of course you have your KRs and your goals and your projects that you're working on. But I will say that other priorities come in, especially like employee relations and stuff like that, because you're just constantly pulling multiple directions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say the constant juggling and prioritizing and just the sad acceptance that sometimes your quarterly goals just aren't going to be met.
Because you're funny. The sad acceptance. Yes. Sometimes goals get pushed off. Yes. And that's funny because I commented on a LinkedIn post just today and this HR leader, I can't recall the company, we're connected. I'm just not picturing it right now, but he had posted a list of three recent failures that he had personally experienced. He said, you know, we're not going to hit this particular goal of this. We're not, I think we're trying to reduce retention, increase retention, reduce turnover, and oh, there were two other, oh, he was training for a marathon. He's like, I've hurt my hip. I can't do it. Something like that, right? And it was so refreshing. And so I actually, it compelled me to comment and say, you know, how much I appreciated this, because we're so often, I mean, I'm as guilty as the next person, guilty of, you know, posting the highlight reel or only talking about the highlights. And, you know, there's a lot to be learned, as we were speaking about earlier, from failure, from, you know, geez, so what does this mean? Does this mean that, you know, everything's, we got to just burn the house down? No, it's a bit more about, it's a pivot, it's a chance to pivot. So we're sort of coming full circle, it feels like here.
Yes, that's true. I would say that's the biggest challenge, I think. I mean, I will say that with the caveat, you're never really like, you are a team of one, but you're also like not, because you have, you know, your other leaders in the organization, you have people to bounce ideas off of. So I don't actually ever feel like I'm alone in my efforts. And I think that can kind of translate into the opportunity. So one of the biggest opportunities as a team of one is you get to closely work with all those business partners, all those leaders that your policies, your programs, your, you know, employee relations are all impacting. So there isn't that siloed disconnect that sometimes you see in a larger organization. Yes.
That's the word that was flying through my head as you were saying that, was silos. Like that has a positive impact on keeping silos at bay, because, you know, so many of the, you know, my clients and people that I talk to day in, day out, just for the show, silos, it's a real thing, right? There's a real need to influence all of those different stakeholders or earn the right to be at the table, because you're it, that may be less of a barrier.
It is. And I would say, yes, I agree with you. And one of the most beautiful aspects of it too, that I think, is that you can set these policies and programs, and the company will have their mission and their values and their visions. And because of that close connection and that lack of barriers, you know, you can kind of constantly make sure or ensure that each team is kind of still working towards those. Like everyone's still on track, right? So you shouldn't be too surprised if you do like a company survey or polls. Most people know the vision and they know how their work adds to that vision and the mission. So I think that's really one of the biggest opportunities. But there are so many opportunities, as many as challenges. You know, like, sure, I can make any changes I want. I mean, I have to have obviously like backing from my team and stuff. But I can put together the data myself and I can say like, this is what I think we should do. And, you know, I kind of have that ownership to do that. So that's also quite delightful in a way.
I agree. Well, and so what is your, you know, most essential piece of advice then for people that are currently in a similar situation as you, or who are thinking they might move to us? You know, they're looking at opportunities right now. They might be in transition and they're thinking about.
I have two pieces of advice. Really good ones. Two, I think. One is like, there are an incredible amount of like critical, just daily tasks that have to happen in HR. And that's great. But don't like get drowned in those tasks. Like as an HR person of one, even a small HR team, you've got to make sure that you're still focusing on the overall big picture and you do have like kind of policies and plans for the future. So, because if you're living like just for the moment and you're just focusing on those tasks only, you're going to burn out so quickly. Or if you work on a small team, you're going to start to get kind of disconnected from that small team. So if you have like, you know, and that's coming from personal experience. So a lesson learned. The other thing that I would say is essential and a great piece of advice, and also something I learned down the road, is you don't have to be like the smartest person in the room and know everything about HR. And you should reach out to your colleagues. They're not HR professionals, but you know what? They've had other jobs. So they've probably had other experiences. You know, rely on, you know, your colleagues' experiences to give advice to you and to help you out. So currently I'm going to start reviewing HRIS programs. I'm a team of one. My operations manager has offered to help. I brought up the idea and he's like, yeah, I'm totally going to help you with it. He's not in HR, but he's like down to help and I'm psyched. So like, you know, reaching out and getting support when you need it and just listening to advice from your peers is always very helpful.
I appreciate that. I really love, you know, you touched on it earlier too, about the fact, you know, when you were talking about opportunities, that you do have other team members. They're just not called HR, but they are people that you work next to, like this operations manager. So really looking at your colleagues internally, I think HR and talent people in big organizations forget to do this sometimes too, right? To engage their peers in the other verticals, right? Which can go a long way to breaking down silos. Just because, you can sort of get into this mode of, nobody knows what it's like in here. But it's also about reaching out, nurturing, building a network externally and having colleagues and networks. I mean, that's my raison d'etre. That's what I pride myself on doing and providing, because it can feel lonely in this role.
Definitely.
Right? You're privy to so much stuff. You've got such a broad perspective across the whole organization and all that insight into each employee and a lot of private information. So it can feel a little bit like, who do I get to talk to sometimes?
It is true. I will say I do miss having HR like direct team members when there's like those real challenging like employee issues that just like, break your heart. But that's why I have a dog and two cats at home.
See? Yeah. I love
They're
it.
Like therapy.
Animals are so supportive. We just adopted a brother for Jesse, actually, our senior rescue dog. So he's arriving on Saturday. Aww. We're very excited. But yeah, so now I have two dogs to talk to during the day when I'm going a little nutty.
It's pretty great. I got to admit.
It is. I think that's your third piece of advice we need to leave people with. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and really giving us some really interesting insight into your world and into what you've learned. It's been very, very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been lovely. You're a delight to speak with. And I really enjoy listening to your podcast. I hope this inspires more people to listen.
Yeah, me too. I've got some amazing guests like you and more to come. Let me tell you, it's an exciting year. Absolutely. I've got a lot of really great, great people coming on. Well, thanks again, Jewel.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your colleagues. Better yet, head over to iTunes and let us know. When you subscribe and leave me a 5-star review, not only do I glow from within, but more people will learn about the show and why they should listen. Until next time, keep telling the talent management truth.